You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Josh.
Hi, Bob. Pleasure to be back on your show.
Pleasure to have you. I'm grateful you could take the time. A lot is happening in your realm of expertise. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Joshua Landis, a professor at the University of Oklahoma. And what, you're like director of the Center of Middle East Studies there or something?
That is very true. Sandra Mackey chair too. Shout out to Sandra Mackey.
God bless her. Mm-hmm. And you're a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute as well.
I am.
So I hear that the Middle East has been active. Let me ask you this question. Now, you teach at a university. Most classes at universities have a broad range of students, ranging from those who are paying a lot of attention to the course and to any relevant news, and to those who aren't. And suppose you run into a student in the latter category, and they just like they caught wind of this on TV, like there was some kind of attack, like Iran attacked Israel over the weekend. How would you try to boil it if they said, like, why did this happen? Like, what's going on? How would you try to boil it down for them?
Well, you know, I think there's a few takeaways from this that are very obvious and that are being chatted up by everybody. And that's, you know, one, for Iran, Iran has defied Napoleon's famous saying, which is never interrupt an enemy when he's making a mistake. And Israel has been making a mistake in Gaza and turning international opinion against it by striking Israel directly as it did. Iran has managed to close ranks back between Biden and Netanyahu. In fact, Britain and France and most of the international community, the EU, has spoken out very emphatically in favor of Israel and saying, we stand with you against Iran. You know, Iran is the enemy, not Israel. And that's very good for Netanyahu. It gives him, it takes the focus away from Gaza, puts it on Iran. And so Iran, I think, has kicked an own goal in this attack. Secondly, it shows how weak Iran is. Iran shot over 300 missiles and drones towards Israel. Almost all of them were shot down before they reached Israeli airspace. So it looks like Iran is, you know, shooting blanks. And then it proved how successful the United States and Israel's defensive plans have been in their technology in the region, this sort of U.S. constructed umbrella. It shows that the currency of war, the American currency of arms buildup and sort of a NATO-like umbrella over Israel works. America has not withdrawn from the region. And it shows the Gulf powers like Saudi Arabia, UAE, and others who've joined the Abraham Accords, if not all the way tentatively, allowed Israel back into CENTCOM. If you recall, up until 2 years ago, Israel was in the European command structure because the Arabs would not have it in Central Command, which is the Middle Eastern region. And Israel got put back in Central Command and integrated into the American system. And that's one of the reasons that this all worked so well for Israel, is because America could use all of its radar and get Saudi and Jordanian and Qatari and UAE buy-in. And it worked. Now, obviously, there's a price to pay in terms of public opinion for the Saudis and others. But I'm not sure how high that price is.
In the Arab world, you mean?
Yes, the street, you know, the famous Arab street and Arab public opinion. But these are very hardened dictatorships that don't always have to pay attention to the public. So a little bit of public anger may not do very much.
Yeah. And Jordan helped, UAE helped, I guess maybe Egypt did, I don't know. But you think they can all manage?
In Qatar, we have big bases that were involved in this. I mean, all these countries were helping. Bahrain, you name it. They may not have been helping so much actively, but by, you know, by helping America with bases and everything else.
So before we get to what may happen next, because there is the prospect of Israeli retaliation, which I guess if mishandled could wind up being another example of interrupting an enemy when it's in the process of making a mistake, but we'll see. But before we get to that, so, you know, one place to start this story is when Israel attacked the, you know, killed several commanders, military commanders from Iran who are in Syria. One was very, very high ranking general, I think. They were said to be in a diplomatic compound or something. I don't know if you've gotten to the bottom of the actual legal status of what that was. But Iran said that that was its status. And therefore, I guess Iran considered that an attack on sovereign Iranian territory. Of course, in any event, it was an attack on somebody's territory other than Israel's. I mean, as a matter of international law, if it wasn't Iranian, it was Syrian territory. First of all, do you know what the best way to characterize that piece of territory is? I'm still kind of confused. But the next question is going to be
was,
how big
it was. Let me just jump in. Yeah. And it was the consular office. If you look at the photos, the Iranian embassy is standing here, and it's the building right almost attached to it, which is the consular offices where they were meeting in an upstairs office with these 16 people were killed, including this extremely, you know, this the top ranked Al-Quds commander for the region who was coordinating relations with Syria and Hezbollah and so forth. So it was a big kill for Israel, but it did defy international norms by attacking this embassy compound. And Iran said quite starkly that had the UN Security Council condemned this, Iran would not have felt compelled to strike back.
And the U.S. the U.S. prevented the condemnation.
Yes, the U.S., Britain, and France all vetoed it. And so, you know, this escalation has defied the norms, the diplomatic norms, the rules-based order, which we've seen collapsing since the beginning of the Gaza campaign, where America has defied many of its own basic laws and war precepts. So this is just one more of them. And it's escalated because Iran felt compelled, I think, from domestic pressure and pressure from its allies across the region who've been taking big hits in Iran's name. And many of them begin to carp and say, you know, Iran, why don't you do something directly? And I think it felt that it had to respond in some dramatic way. But, it, you know, as commentators have already pointed out, it telegraphed all this information. This was a performative, you know, venture on the part of Iran because it told Saudi Arabia 2 days ahead of time that it was going to do this, use its airspace, so forth. Saudi Arabia told the United States, and they were ready and waiting.
And do you think that was part of an intention on Iran's part to actually, in a sense, minimize casualties? I mean, we should go back. There's an analog to this. When the U.S. Yeah. assassinated Soleimani, an even higher ranking commander in Iraq during the Trump administration, what Iran did was send ballistic missiles to U.S. military barracks in Iraq, but apparently pass word through a third party that was going to happen. So there weren't any soldiers there. At least that's my understanding. And that was, I thought, a pretty effective show where Iran apparently didn't want to kill anybody, but wanted to show them we can destroy barracks if we want to. And first of all, correct me if I've got anything wrong there. But then the question is, was Iran almost, did they almost want a certain number of these missiles intercepted, as crazy as it sounds, because they were afraid of what would happen if they killed too many people or something?
Yes, I think Iran wanted to minimize. It wanted to make a show. mm-hmm. that it was engaged in this, that it saw this as a provocation that would not stand. Whether it expected that none of its rockets would get through, I just don't know. That is unknown to me, but clearly they telegraphed this all. They told everybody that what they were going to do, and they sent them out, which indicates that they didn't really want to hurt Israel. They wanted to show the world that they're in the game and that they're not just sitting on their hands.
Yeah, you think they wanted to destroy some stuff, a bunch of stuff probably. Probably their ideal world would be they blow up a bunch of stuff very vividly and don't kill anybody, because then there's less chance of significant Israeli retaliation, although it's starting to look like there may be some of that anyway.
Right. And I think they wanted to show the Arabs that that the Arabs shouldn't be stampeding towards the United States, right? That they should be sitting, they should be taking this, increasing their neutral stand, as they did mm-hmm. on the Ukraine war, keeping America at some sort of a distance and putting a halt to the Abraham Accords and increasing reliance on China, too, because all of the Gulf states have been exploring and exploring greater and greater alliances with China, military exchanges, joining the Asian alliance, talking about a currency, you know, doing exchanges. Saudi Arabia has explored it, trading in local currencies and avoiding the dollar, all these sorts of things, and using Huawei telephones, which America has said you can't do if you're going to get our top flight technology, but also opening up a lot of technology exchange. And Saudi Arabia has been housing various high technology, getting missile technology from China and so forth. It's all things that America doesn't want it to do. So mm-hmm. I think that, you know, that's the game. And here has been a very dramatic show that American might and Israeli might is still very strong. And the Arab world on October 7th, one of the lessons that many Arabs drew from October 7th was that Israel is not that strong. Israel uh-huh. is weak, and that eventually it's going to face a strong Arab foe, right, that can hurt it, and that Jews are going to flee, and the Jews who have two passports are going to go back to Europe or something like that. This was a lesson that many people thought. It was like bin Laden attacking. I mean, I hate to make that comparison, but a little bit, this was a lesson that Middle East, that the Palestinian Hamas was trying to show the weakness of Israel. And so Israel, in pounding Gaza, in making these demonstrations, is trying to repair that reputation in the region as an all-powerful force. And I think to a certain extent, both the U.S. and America, both U.S. and Israel are, you know, pounding their chests a little bit today and doing a little victory march and saying, and Biden told Israel, take the win. Don't escalate mm-hmm. anymore, because they see it very clearly as a big win for them.
But as we tape this in the afternoon of Tuesday, it's looking like there will be some Israeli retaliation.
You know, that's a big question that's on everybody's mind. And I've been talking to a bunch of friends and some people in Israel. And here's what I expect. I expect that Israel will keep up a steady drumbeat of airstrikes against Iranian and pro-Iranian military bases in Lebanon, Syria, possibly into Iraq. It will intensify its mm-hmm. efforts to assassinate top Iranian leaders, Hezbollah leaders, Hamas leaders, wherever they are, whether it's Lebanon, Syria, so forth, as they've been doing. Israel's strategy of raising the cost to Iran and its allies in the region is working. It deflects international attention from Gaza, provides leeway for Biden administration to remain firmly in Israel's camp where it wants to be, and underlines the weakness of Iran and its allied militias, while highlighting the strength of the U.S.-Israeli regional military umbrella and alliances. it also shows the Gulf leaders the wisdom of sticking close to CENTCOM and the Abraham Accords. You know, it shows that the American currency of power and military might is still the dominant currency in the Middle East, and that China, the future doesn't necessarily belong to China, at least not as soon as many people think. And, you know, then that raises the question of, will Israel strike Iran directly? And, you know, my answer to that, I guess, although I can't read the Israeli government that well, I would expect that Israel will explore strikes on Iranian soil at a time and place of its choosing, as Israeli leaders have said they would do. And a direct attack from Iran opened the door for Israel to explore this option. And the logic of doing so for Israel, I think, is very strong. Why? Because many Israeli generals argued that maintaining crippling sanctions on Iran was much more important than keeping Iran from developing uranium. And this was at the time when Trump and of the Obama deal, and when Israel was dead set against the Obama deal with Iran that would stop, that would lift sanctions in exchange for Iran stopping to refine uranium. And many Israeli generals at the time argued, look, it's better to have a poor Iran under very strict sanctions, even at the price of it developing and refining its uranium.
And why is that?
Why was that? That's because a lot of Israeli generals felt, we can bomb Iran's nuclear facilities the way we bombed Iraq's and Syria's nuclear facilities. But once you allow Iran to escape the sanctions, get back into the international banking system, and normalize relations with countries like France, Germany, so forth, and the United States, it'll be very hard to revert back to sanctions, but it'll be even more damaging to Israel. Because once Iran, which at one time was exporting 5-6 million barrels of oil a day, today is exporting 1 million barrels of oil a day, used to be less when the Trump administration was really tightening the sanctions. Biden has loosened up a little bit, and it's gone up to about a million and a half. But if it were to export 5 or 6 million barrels of oil a day, which it could do after some investment, it would have the money to really begin to develop its military potential, its conventional military potential, as well as to fund these proxy militias, these allied militias like Hezbollah, the militias in Iraq and the Houthis and so forth. It would give it a lot more money in its pockets to do damage to Israel. And that's what I think Israel really fears, is escaping this sanctions regime. Today, Iran is poor. And if we look at, you know, what's happened to the Iranian currency, I looked it up just today. It's collapsed since this Iranian strike on Israel. There are 42,000 Iranian rials to a dollar. And this is the result of sanctions. Iranians are poor today. They are very angry at their own government. They feel like this whole war with Israel is a giant distraction that is coming straight out of their pockets, and it's causing, you know, is immiserating them. And so many Iranians are furious at the government. This is coming at a very high price for them. So in that sense, the Israeli strategy is, we're going to have to bomb those facilities, nuclear facilities, at some time. Iran's action in bombing us directly means that we're not starting this, and we can begin to probe by little attacks into Iran, figure out their defenses, and establish a way to destroy their nuclear facilities if we need to in the future.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into more of the consequences of this, to rewind the tape a little. So when Israel did the, you know, kind of escalated, and it was treated that way, when Israel did this strike, there was a story about it in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. Clear. It was a big thing. It was a clear escalation. It was called that. And I guess one question is, why do you think Israel did it? I mean, there's two kinds of motivations, like geopolitical and political. Paul Pillar did a piece for a Responsible Statecraft suggesting that Netanyahu, to some extent, wanted to just change the story, change the narrative. Things weren't working out in Gaza. And even up to the point of drawing the U.S. into a war against Iran, I think Paul said, Netanyahu wouldn't have minded that. But in any event, he just wanted to switch the script for political purposes. Now, obviously, you can cite geopolitical advantages of killing the generals in an adversary of an adversary state. Well, so but how do you see the motivation overall?
I think Paul Pillar is right on. I think this does change the narrative. It's very similar to what Netanyahu did way back at the beginning of the Obama administration. President Obama demanded and asked Netanyahu to freeze settlement construction in the West Bank because Obama wanted to kickstart peace negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Netanyahu didn't want peace. He didn't want to get into these difficult negotiations, and he didn't want a Palestinian state, and he didn't want to be talking to the PLO. So what did he do? He made a most tremendous end run around President Obama by going to Congress, where he was applauded in standing ovations, about 2 to 3 times more often than Obama himself. And he got over 120 U.S. congressmen to fly to Israel, go to the West Bank, stand in a settlement, and say, Israel is not the enemy, Iran is the enemy. He got Congress to stand up and salute for Israel. And this shut down Obama's efforts. Obama looked like a naive sucker who had no clue the way Washington worked. And he didn't. He didn't realize the true measure of the pro-Israeli strength in American political landscape. And so that's what's happening here, I think, except for that Biden administration wants to be close to Israel. They're frightened of escalation. They don't want to get dragged into a war. But I think that there are probably many people in the administration who welcome the narrative being switched because they were being put in a very uncomfortable position where they had to condemn Israel, even though they want to be ironclad in their support of Israel.
But, to me, if Biden wants Israel not to retaliate with an attack on Iranian soil, which I think they genuinely want.
Yes, I agree with you.
To me, the idea that they could have played as big a role as they just played in keeping Israel secure and to be playing as big a role as they're playing in supplying them weapons for the Gaza war, and to not be able to just tell them, we do not want you to retaliate on Iranian soil, for them not to be able to hold Israel to that, I find just mind-blowing. I mean, maybe I don't understand the way geopolitics works, but I had always thought that kind of thing was possible in a situation like this with what is nominally at least a superpower and a client state that at that very moment is providing all kinds of critical support. I genuinely don't get, and I would add that I kind of thought that after the strike on the aid workers in Gaza, And Biden apparently finally read the Riot Act to Netanyahu and got a little something out of it, I thought maybe he had kind of discovered that it was possible to use leverage. But I don't know. I mean, can you explain to me how the U.S. doesn't have the leverage to just say, look, for the next 6 months, we do not want to see a strike on Iranian soil or something like that, and just have them respect it? I really don't get it.
I think he could do that, but he's in an election cycle, right? In 6 months, we've got elections.
Mm-hmm.
He's raising money. He has raised $170 million. I don't know what the number is now, but it's been going up dramatically. Biden has raised more money than any other presidential candidate by this time in his campaign than any other president, mm-hmm. much more than Trump. I think his pro-Israeli narrative is one of the keys to his success in raising that money. Now, that comes at the price of Arab American voters in Michigan and maybe a few places. And we don't really know how much they're not going to vote for Biden because, of course, the alternative is voting for Trump. So I think that the Biden administration is making a careful calculation. Does ironclad support for Israel hurt us?
But here's what I don't get. Here's what I don't get. How many pro-Israel people in America genuinely think it's in Israel's like vital interest to attack Iran right now? I think if anything, it's probably a mistake. But I mean, from Israel's point of view, I don't know. But it's not some kind of, I mean, as you've just established, Israel won this round, right? Like, yes. This is a huge success.
But there's another round that's coming. And there's another round that's coming, which is Gaza, the end game, UNRWA. Will the world close ranks with the Palestinians and help them rebuild in Gaza, or will it allow them to languish and Israel to remain the dominant power and occupy Gaza, which is what Netanyahu wants, right?
And what's the connection between that and striking Iran right now?
Because it takes the spotlight off of Gaza. It allows the United States to close ranks with Israel to get an Israeli win, and it shows it fulfills the Netanyahu and Israel narrative, which is we are an outpost of Western civilization on the gates of Asia and the Islamic world. These Islamic extremists, meaning Hamas and the Palestinians writ large and basically just the Muslim world, are going to be bursting into Europe and the West unless you help us keep them pinned back over here, which has been the language that the Israeli president and the various ministers have been constantly saying to Europe. You know, better to fight them over here than fight them in your home turf. That's the Israeli line. We're holding back the barbarians. This Iran struggle is a way for the Israeli government and pro-Israeli interest groups to keep the focus on the barbarians. That there is this larger alliance of forces that's inimical to not only Israel, but the larger West. And that's the real enemy. It's not Israel. It's not settlers. It's not killing Palestinians. That is a sideshow to this larger struggle. And so Israel, by attacking Iran, keeping this escalation humming, the danger, the international danger of a counterstrike from Iran is, it fulfills that more radical apocalyptic message, which is this is the West against the rest.
And so it looks like this was a political masterstroke by Bibi Netanyahu to kill those generals in Syria, I mean, in the diplomatic compound. And it looks like I now see all the more clearly why you think the kind of retaliation we saw from Iran was a mistake, because it does fit in with the narrative of Iran trying to quote, wipe Israel off the map, which actually turns out to be a subtle mistranslation of something that actually was said. But anyway, as you know, it's a very repeated assertion. And of course, Iran does, for both, probably geopolitical and political reasons, say a lot of hostile things about Israel. But anyway, it fits directly into that narrative. And this is kind of a footnote, but I'm wondering what else Iran could have done. Everyone kind of knew they were going to have to retaliate. And I did not think they would retaliate on Israeli soil from Iran with a return address. I thought, well, if they have a way of doing what Israel does in Iran every once in a while, which is assassinate a nuclear scientist or somebody, they would do that and just not take credit for it, but everyone would know. Or if they have a way of striking military barracks, even in Gaza, not Israel proper, maybe, or something originating from a proxy onto Israeli soil, Golan Heights, maybe. But I didn't anticipate this. I, in fact, predicted it wouldn't happen. And on the other hand, I have to admit that I don't know exactly what else was practical for Iran to do by way of retaliation. Do you, you've probably thought about that, right?
Yes. I mean, the same thing happened with Soleimani. there have been many provocations. I mean, Israel has bombed Syria over 200 times in the last several years. It's almost twice a week, sometimes more than twice a week. It's
often killing Iranian personnel and sometimes
Iranian personnel, mostly Syrians, but Syrians who are, you know, Syria's allied with and Hezbollah operatives and militia people who are pro-Iranian. And of course, the entire Syrian army is pro-Iranian. So all you have to say is I killed some pro-Iranians, and you can kill just about anybody you want in the region, and they're pro-Iranian. But it's been weakening Iran's military effort to build up Syria, Hezbollah, so forth. And Israel has been, you know, had a steady series of strikes. They haven't been this big. They haven't hit, you know, diplomatic compounds. So Israel's clearly escalated in this, but also the world is watching very carefully now because of the Gaza situation, because the whole place is so loaded. And it's embarrassing the Saudis and Gulf Arab states that are trying to keep some kind of a lower profile on this. But Iran could have, to answer your question, Iran should have said, we will pick a time and place that's convenient for us. And allowed, you know, going back to my original Napoleon misquote of, you know, never stop an enemy when they're shooting themselves in the foot. Let the focus remain on Gaza, because the international community was moving away, was getting to the point where it would have to respond, it would have to do something to use this leverage that it has against Israel, and that Biden is so reluctant to use. But he was getting to the point where he had to do something. And he'd done these micro little pricks, like put sanctions on four settlers or, you know, these sorts of things, which he then lifted largely because he let them do their banking in Israel. It was putting pressure, and it was dividing, as we were beginning to see little rays of light between Israel and the United States that weren't there before. And so Iran, I think, is badly, I understand the domestic pressures for Iran to escalate in face of escalation. I think it's misdone. And if Israel, we'll see how this goes. There's obviously a lot of pressure on Arab regimes now who are embarrassed by this. Saudi Arabia just got off the phone with their Chinese counterparts, in which they were asking for China intercession, asking China to use its good offices with Israel to calm this down, not to have a strike on Iran, and to promote a two-state solution. So Saudi Arabia, I think, has been embarrassed in front of the Arab world, and it's trying to do some damage control here by calling China. And it shows that it's not just in America's camp, because it helped. You know, it had worked with America to shoot down these Iranian missiles. And now it's got to say, no, we're not totally in America's camp. We're in China's camp as well, and we're keeping this. But it's a rear guard action on the part of Saudi Arabia. But that's what's going on in the Middle East.
It's interesting that America is so reluctant to use the leverage it has, that Saudi Arabia is appealing to China, which has radically less leverage with Israel than we have. But you would have said pick a time and place of your we'll pick a time and place of our choosing, and I guess that might have assuaged
Iran's advantage in the region has been very clear, which is Iran over the last 30 years has been able to take over Lebanon through Hezbollah by building a militia there. The Shiites of Lebanon, 30% of the population, used to be the weakest element in Lebanon. They were the dirt farmers in the south. Nobody paid attention to them. They had very minimal political clout and were not unified. Ever since the Israeli invasion in 82, when Hezbollah began to form as a resistance operation, and the Iranians began to use that and train them, now, today, Hezbollah is the deciding factor in the Israeli political scene. It's got the largest military force. And Iran is, you know, Iran is the dominant power in Lebanon. Same is true in Syria. Same is true in Iraq. So Iran has been able to extend it. You know, it used to be Saddam Hussein who hated the Iranians and attacked them and had a terrible war for 8 years and was presented himself as the shield in front of Sunni Arab world, in front of these Persian interlopers. Today, Iraq is in Iran's pocket. Syria is, Lebanon is, Yemen is too, through the Houthis. So
well, Iran, but, although I'm told that they have more autonomy, that they have an unusual amount of autonomy as so-called
proxies
go.
All of these countries have autonomy. They can't, yeah. They don't have to do everything that Iran wants. It's a negotiation. They're allies, just the way Israel has autonomy from the United States. But if the United States wants to use its leverage, which it doesn't, you know, we've seen the way this works. But the point is, there's no exact analogy here, but there is autonomy. But Iran, there's a common interest in sticking together and coming up with a plan. Now, the United States and Israel has raised the cost of being an ally of Iran tremendously. You look at the state of the economies in Lebanon, Israel, Iraq, Yemen. These countries have been brought to their knees. There's been civil war. They've had opposition groups funded against them. It's terrible sanctions. They've been crushed economically. Iran, at this point, has done, I think, as much as it can militarily in the Middle East, and it needs to come up with a viable economic plan of building its own economy and spreading some love to its allies instead of just having them all suffer infinitely. And not only are Iranian people trying to leave Iran because this economic situation is so bad, but so are Syrians and Iraqis and Lebanese. Everybody's trying to get out of there because it's a misery. And so Iran needs to really, like Russia, Iran needs to find a solution, or find a viable future for itself in this Eastern-looking world. And China's interest is to
By
make
Eastern-looking, you mean what?
Towards China, towards uh-huh. Russia. Being allied with Russia and China, being cut off from the West, sanctioned up to your nostrils.
Yeah, but that's why they're sanctioned up to their nostrils, to some extent. In other words, they're being part of what we perceive to be the new, you know, other half of the Cold War, Russia and China. It reinforces our incentive to subject them to sanctions, I guess. Although, or maybe you see it as mainly about Israel, our incentive. I don't know.
No. It is, there's a contest going out in there. And Biden has said it's the contrast of the democracies against the tyrannies and all this other stuff. But there's a new Cold War, as you're underlining. And China, it's China's interest, right, to show that it can win this war. That trade, that its industrial power, its intelligence has an option that's going to provide for a brighter future for people, that America is a waning power that cannot compete. And that's ultimately, you know, many Americans say, yes, we can win. We can win against Russia. We can win this war. And we have to cut off all trade with China. That's what our new congressmen are running on this. You know, the Republicans are running on this. Let's ratchet up and protection, you know, ban all Chinese electric cars from American market, right? Because they're a danger. They're being flooded into American market. So, and to a sense, Iran and that Middle Eastern world is a sharp end of the spear, if you will. If it fails, it's going to look bad for third world countries that are trying to remain neutral or even leaning towards China as a viable option to the United States.
At the same time, it's not so clear to me that China was initially so insistent on seeing the Middle East as a place of contest in exactly this sense. What I mean is, if you look back before October 7th, the last thing China had done in the region was orchestrate a kind of little bit of a rapprochement between Iran and the Sunni Arab states. Now, maybe their long-term goal was to turn the Sunni Arab states more firmly against Israel, but that's not so much my impression. I mean, I think China would be happy to see as the great stabilizer, be seen as the great stabilizer of the Middle East. In any event, it seemed like a potentially constructive thing to start bridging that rift, since it was itself a potentially explosive thing. So, I mean, is that naive to think that...
I think you're right there. I mean, China does not want to be anti-Israel. I don't think China wants to be, China wanted to buy Israel. China wanted to redo the Haifa port. It wanted to get its fingers into Israel and become a major trading partner. And Israel has supplied China with tons of its military technology. Most of China's missile technology and so forth came from Israel, which got it from the United States and then sold it to China. The United States has had to wrap Israel on the knuckles a number of times for this kind of military technology transfer. So I think China doesn't like this military contest that's going on because it puts China on its back foot and is forcing Gulf countries to choose one way or the other. Whereas China wants stability and to allow Saudi Arabia, UAE, and the others to make more and more deals with China, which they are doing.
Right.
And China is weak militarily. It doesn't have the power to compete with America militarily. Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries are going to stick with America at least for the next 10, 15 years because America does supply them with this security umbrella, which they need. And so I think you're right. On the other hand, what we're seeing China do is get more military bases, Horn of Africa. They're building military bases. They've got a base in the United Arab Emirates, which they goes off and on depending on how much America is pressuring them not to go on. And it's developing its trade with Iraq and with Syria and with Lebanon and other places. It's moving into the Gulf because, after all, we can't forget that the vast majority of China's energy is coming straight out of the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Gulf, if you will, from Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And America can choke China by shutting the Gulf oil exports to China. If there was an ever a conflagration, America's going to cut that off. So Saudi Arabia, I mean, for China, in the long run, to guarantee their own national security, their energy imports, they need to secure those alliances in the Gulf.
And
we saw with the Houthis attacking trade and so forth, this damages China. So China needs to begin to build its Navy power, its bases, in the effort to replace America someday and to offer a viable alternative to these Gulf countries.
No, I think inevitably this is, well, not inevitably, but it is becoming more and more of a point of contest in the Middle East. But I would just go back and underscore, my point is kind of that I think China's domestic politics allow it to play, in principle, a more or less impartial and stabilizing role in the Middle East in the way that ours don't. I mean, you just said yourself that, yes, it would be in the interest of the world for Biden to use the leverage he has to keep Israel from retaliating on Iranian soil, since obviously it's going to be hard for Iran not to retaliate for that. Yes, that would be in the world's interest. Yes, it would be in the region's interest. Yes, it might save lives in the long run. But because of domestic politics and because of Biden's domestic politics compel him to do what's good for Bibi Netanyahu, and it's good for Bibi Netanyahu politically, to keep the story focused on Iran. So that's just an illustration of what I mean. The U.S. is not equipped to be a constructive force in the Middle East. As a U.S. taxpayer, this really kind of bothers me. I mean, obviously, Gaza has driven the point home. I don't like to see my tax dollars going to kill a ton of people, but it's just a source of frustration.
Well, it's another forever war that we don't have a way out of. And it's quite clear that there needs to be a two-state solution, ultimately, for Palestinians.
Do you think that's still possible?
No, I do not. But I think that America has painted itself. You know, the Biden administration has said we cannot return to the status quo and there has to be a two-state solution. And yet it has none of the ability or really, I think, the intention to try to fulfill that. It has not disciplined Israel in the settler violence in the last few weeks has been tremendous. There have been a number of Palestinians in West Bank killed, land taken, villages burnt. It's boiling. And the West Bank is going to be turned into Gaza eventually because the West Bankers are losing land and they're getting forced into smaller and smaller bits, which are going to look like Gaza and where the desperation level is going up and up. And they're going to become radicalized because the PLO has failed. The peace process has failed. And they're getting treated like rats. And they are becoming rats, as the Gazans have become, in a sense. And they're going to strike out and have, you know, there's going to be bad leadership with bad formulas for trying to solve this problem, more radical formulas that's going to breed Islamic fundamentalism. And all these angry children who've lost their families and so forth are going to be angry. And they're going to come up with angry solutions. And that's the future. I think many people in the region see it. I think the Gulf Arabs, you know, people see it. Many Israelis see it. But the Netanyahu government has decided they can overcome that, that they can manage this anger, keep the Palestinians hemmed in. They can take most of the land. And their, you know, their mission to settle Judea and Gaza and Samaria and so forth, it can go ahead. This sort of messianic dream of getting all the land. And so Netanyahu thinks, I can manage America. Conflict is good because it's through this conflict that we're going to be able to take more of the land and settle this issue once and for all. That there's not going to be.
Meaning, in part, conflict with Iran helps us, with the other hand, be doing this in Gaza and the West Bank.
There's not going to be a good outcome in Gaza. The Gazans are going to be left in a very rump part of Gaza Strip in no housing at all. There's going to be arguments over how to proceed, and no money is going to flow in. UNRWA, which was the major avenue for advancement for Gazans, has been largely destroyed.
That's the UN relief. The
Nations Refugee and Relief, whatever agency. And that, you know, the education system in Gaza, American educators who've worked closely with the education system say that the Gazan education system was very good. And we got there were many smart kids coming out because of UNRWA schools, UN funded schools, that Gazans were getting a large percentage of the Fulbright grants to come study for short terms in the United States and elsewhere, that they were producing some very high quality engineers and computer people and so forth that were coming out and doing very well. Now that all those school system has been destroyed and there is less and less hope for a future for these
people. Now, UNRWA, as you said, has itself been more or less destroyed. And just to quickly review, the reason is Israel said 12 of their people or something were involved in the October 7th attack. Well, there's 13,000 workers for UNRWA in Gaza, and they largely hire Palestinians. It's not like Europeans come. There are Europeans, but I mean, they hire a ton of Palestinians. Hamas is the government as well as the army. And everything else. I mean, inevitably, if you hire, you know, thousands and thousands of people in a country that has the relationship to Israel that it has, you're going to wind up with some who are. I mean, that just shouldn't have surprised anybody that there is going to be some overlap of personnel.
Right. It is a very small overlap, and it's natural. Yeah. It's like police force and everything else. Of course. Now, if you want to look at the the dark side of the fallout of all this. And I think
there's
going to be a very dark side and a long-term fallout. You know, the example that I use is Bin Laden as a young university student, not even that, but as a university graduate from university, was looking in 1982 when Israel bombed Beirut in order to try to destroy the Palestinians. Bin Laden was watching that on TV, and it was well covered on TV. Right. And he says that the idea of bombing the World Trade Center first came to him when he watched F-16s bombing Beirut. And he believed that the United States needed payback. And he said, I began to fantasize about destroying the big buildings of New York when I saw the buildings of Beirut being taken down. And now, whether that is something he came up with for his big announcement of attacking the World Trade Center, or, you know, as a revenge scenario, or whether that was actually the way, and it probably is some truth to it. The point is that here, 30 years later, at 12, when he struck the World Trade Center, it took 30 years to breed that kind of a plan for revenge. And what's happening in Gaza and the Middle East today is causing immense anger and breaking down, breaking down connections between East and West. And there's going to be a radicalization that takes place because of it, a lot of it. And just when we think we're winning the war on terror, that ISIS and Al-Qaeda have been largely defanged, and that the Middle East is settling down, as our Secretary of State said. And
of course,
back again.
I mean, and we reacted to 9/11 by invading Iraq and turning it into a de facto quasi-ally of Iran's, which has exacerbated the current situation from Israel's point of view. And if, for that matter, the Israeli incursion in Lebanon made that place ripe for Iranian influence. And our destabilization of Syria, although Syria was already an ally of Iran's, it wasn't as dependent on Iran before.
No, it was not.
Destabilize the government. Let me say on that note of kind of hatred that festers and eventually turns into violence. Last time you were on, you recommended this documentary called Death in Gaza, which is like, it was made back when Israel still was occupying Gaza before the withdrawal, had settlements there. And that is really, people can get a hold of it. I wound up getting a DVD. I couldn't find a way to stream it, but there may be one. It's really
on YouTube. If you go to YouTube and you look for Death in Gaza, you will find it posted to YouTube. You can watch it for free.
And let me say, the thing about it, it's a true piece of journalism, because to my mind, it kind of shows both sides in the following sense. You know, you hear from kind of the pro-Israel right, you hear, look, the problem is that Hamas has this infrastructure for creating radicals, and if we can eliminate Hamas, and then on the left, they say, no, the problem is the hatred that's being converted into the violence. And in a sense, the documentary shows both sides. There's an extremely creepy scene of Hamas guys kind of grooming a kid who's maybe 14. And they're encouraging him to accept the fact that he may someday be a martyr. It's super, super creepy. There is this infrastructure for converting hatred into militancy and violence. At the same time, you see in the circumstances of daily life during that occupation, of course there's going to be a ton of hatred. Of course this 14-year-old kid is going to see Israelis as people he wants to kill. And of course that's more analogous to the West Bank now. It's a military occupation, the state that Gaza was in then. But what's happened over the last few months is all of that on steroids. I mean, basically everyone in Gaza now has a friend or relative who's been killed or maimed within the last few months. And,
right. You know, one of the things that film, that documentary, which was so important, I think, demonstrated was that every one of these young recruits that Hamas was bringing into their ranks, these young 10, 11, 12-year-olds, who they used as spotters and so forth, had multiple brothers and sisters and cousins who had been killed by Israel. It was very easy to get them to want that revenge and feel that they needed to become a martyr in order to expiate their own guilt of survival and to get revenge for these many family members that had been killed. And so these young kids were ripe, in a sense, for the harvesting for this kind of. And the other thing is that this film, which was made in about 2003, four, just before Israel withdraws in 2005, those kids who are 12, 13, 14, because the documentary only interviews kids, children in Gaza. So you're looking at from these very innocent eyes of 11, 12-year-olds who are just expressing things that they've clearly gotten from their environment, from their parents, from cousins. And you see this hatred of Israelis and this misconception of Jews as somehow Martians who've landed in these big suits and helmets and guns and are just picking them off. And so those kids, though, that were interviewed in that movie today are the Sinwars, are the 52-year-old operatives, the 40-something-year-old operatives who are leading Hamas today. So that generation that you see in that documentary is so important because it helps you understand the psychology of the Hamas leaders today. And the next generation of kids are all out there in those refugee camps now, you know, looking for orange peels on the ground. They're coming up. And those are the potential bin Ladens or whoever. And it's like Jason and the Argonauts with those dragon's teeth being sewed out in the field.
Yeah. And I hate to editorialize too much, but I just want to repeat, the U.S. is the last country you can realistically expect to earnestly try to make things better in the Middle East. I say if we could just give it to China, it would be a better world. But
an hour.
What's that?
It's an hour.
We've been doing this. You're keeping track. You're right. So, and you know, as we said, after an hour, we move into overtime, available to paid subscribers, non-zero newsletter. All you got to do after becoming a paid subscriber is go to the non-zero newsletter on Substack. There will be a post with the rest of this. And also, that's a place where you can set up your podcast feed. So forevermore, you'll have access to the overtime stuff. And Josh, I appreciate your agreeing to stick around and talk some more, because I want to talk about the deep background of this. Like, why? I mean, as you said, Iran, it's part of their identity to be opposed to Israel. And I'd like to talk about how that came to be and why that is, and whether there are. And as you said, it's not working. There are a lot of Iranians who don't think it's working to their advantage. And I want to talk about whether there's things that could be done about that. But first, I want to ask you to tell us where people can find your stuff or anything else you want to say by way of summary or clarification.
Well, that's fine. You know, I'm very active on Twitter. So you can always follow me on Twitter, which is Joshua_Landis. And I write fairly frequently for either the Quincy Institute or Foreign Affairs, so forth. So you can just Google, you'll find my stuff out there.
Responsible Statecraft is the Quincy kind of outlet that you're probably often writing for, right?
Right, indeed. Recently wrote a piece on Syrian sanctions and why a recent bill that just passed in Congress to extend the sanctions for another 8 years is foolish, so forth.
Okay. I also want to ask you in overtime whether the consequences in terms of Israel's own psychology of the success of this defensive effort and whether Bibi will be emboldened by it. But anyway, thanks everybody who stuck around so far. Thanks to those who are following us into overtime. And now we're heading into overtime.